Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Really looking forward to this hour. I've been looking forward to this conversation. It's always good to talk with Steve Weidenkopf, our favorite historian, who teaches in the Graduate School of Christendom College, which everybody tells me is, in addition to being one of the great Catholic colleges, is also just a beautiful place to visit. But I haven't had the privilege yet, but I do love visiting with Steve. Among his books, he's got several books with us at Catholic Answers Press. Among his books is The Glory of the Crusades. Steve Weidenkopf, thank you for being with us.
Hey, Si, thanks for having me on the show again. Glad to see you.
So the Crusades... this is like the on the list of horribles. Do you know the list I'm talking about though, that we hear? Like, oh, yeah. What about the Inquisition? What about the and the Crusades is always way up there. How should we think about the Crusades, given that it's used as a bludgeon against us, I think, in many ways?
Yeah, absolutely. You're exactly right, Si, right? This is one of the most common historical events that Catholics get asked about. And, it's interesting because the crusading movement is one of those historical events that if you will, has widespread recognition. Most people, if you stop them on the street and say the word crusade, they'll have some kind of recognition of the word or of the event, or at least what they think happened during those events. So there's widespread recognition, but there's very little understanding about what this movement actually was, who participated in it, why people participated in it. And as you mentioned, it frequently is used as a historical bludgeon against the church, and really in ways to discredit the church, I think, and limit her influence in the world. So as Catholics, it's vitally important we know the real story of the Crusades in order to answer some of these objections.
Well, let's start there. Why do we say Crusades? How many of them were there?
Yeah, that's a good, it's a big debate, or was a big debate back in the academic community about how do you define a crusade? How many were there? There's different groups of historians that fall on different sides of that question. But generally speaking, in essence, it's important to note that really we should, I like to use the phrase that it's a crusading movement, or it was a crusading movement, not just the Crusades, because a movement bespeaks of something that occurs over a period of time and evolves during the course of that time. So the crusading movement really, one could say, began in the late 11th century. Depending on what camp you fall into, most historians will say that the crusading movement ended in the 17th century. So from the 11th to the 17th century. So we're talking multiple hundreds of years of European and church history. And so the movement obviously evolves too, right? The traditionally numbered crusades, which were these military campaigns of Christian European warriors against Muslims in North Africa and in the Holy Land, there are traditionally eight of those that historians number. And that's what most people think of when they think of the Crusades, right, or the crusading movement, or these campaigns against Muslim forces in the Holy Land and North Africa. And they're from the 11th century, late 11th century, all the way up until the late 13th century. But after that, the movement changes, it evolves. There were all kinds of different forms of crusades. There were crusades against pagan tribes of what are the Baltic states of Europe now, so Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, parts of Poland even. And you had crusades against heretics. So the south of France in particular, the Albigensians, the Cathars there, even had crusades called against enemies of the church. For example, the Holy Roman Emperor Frederick II had a crusade called against him because he got into a political conflict with various popes during his reign.
Oh, wow. So that almost sounds like such a varied movement that labeling it one movement seems almost to stretch the vocabulary. But what's the common thing then? Like if I had to say, what is the crusading movement? What is it?
What is it? Yeah, so it's in essence, one would say that it's a defensive reactionary movement, military movement of Western knights and Western military manpower trying to reconquer, to liberate ancient Christian territory in North Africa and the Holy Land, and also to protect Christian territory from invasion or from enemies of the church, which would include heretics. So that's kind of a general definition. There's a lot of ingredients, if you will, characteristics that would go into distinguishing some kind of armed campaign against Muslim forces or against pagan forces that might not be a crusade. It might just be a regular military campaign of a secular ruler. What distinguishes that from an actual crusade or a movement? And that would be that those who participated in crusades actually took a vow. So these warriors took a vow. Initially, that vow at the beginning of the movement was to go to Jerusalem, specifically to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem, to liberate Jerusalem and the Church, the Holy Sepulchre, from, you know, Islamic control. That was the initial vow. But other crusading vows, as the movement changes, the vow also changed. So there's a vow. Crusades were called by popes. So this was something that was universal for the church. It wasn't just one secular ruler saying, let's go on crusade. It was something that was sponsored by, called for by the pope. Crusaders had certain privileges associated with being able to go on crusade. Their family, their property was protected from attack while they were away on crusade. They couldn't be arrested or tried in secular court. Later on in the movement, actually canonically speaking, the crusaders were considered to be really temporary clerics. So they were protected by canon law and all the kind of privileges that are associated with that, being tried in church courts, not having to pay taxes, for example, receiving hospitality wherever they went on the road from monasteries and the church as well, being free from tolls, so they didn't have to pay tolls on the roads, for example, which was nice. Their property, as I mentioned, was and their family was were protected by the church. So if a neighbor of theirs who didn't go on crusade tried to take their land or attack their family, that neighbor was automatically excommunicated. So the church protected, the crusader while they're protected their family and their property while they're away. And then, you know, another privilege really was a spiritual privilege. Those are more temporal privileges. The spiritual privilege was the granting of the indulgence. So participating in a crusade, one received the spiritual plenary indulgence of the remission of the temporal punishment due to sin, whose guilt has already been forgiven in confession. So that was one of the main motivators for men actually to go, was this unique ability to receive that plenary indulgence, which before the movement had been very restrictive and not utilized and as freely given, if you will, by the church.
I think in the modern mind, there might be a kind of equality given to the crusade and what we know as colonialism, that is like the Spanish and the Portuguese and the British going out into the world and in a certain sense seizing parts of the world for Christendom, but also seizing parts of the world for king and crown. But is there a distinction to be made there, and is it worth making that distinction?
Yeah, there is absolutely a distinction to be made, and is worth making. And it's a great topic to bring up because that's one of the many myths about the Crusades, that these were colonial enterprises. And partly that myth has come about because in the 20th century, after the First World War, when you had the British Mandate in Palestine, where you had the European the victorious Allied powers, if you will, Britain and France. Increasing their colonial territories, overseas, especially in Africa and parts of the Pacific and even in the Holy Land, right? These European powers utilized crusader imagery in their colonial colonization efforts. So that really, to our modern mind, in the modern narrative associated with the Crusades, that linked the two together, although the two events were completely distinct and separate, right? In no way, shape, or form, if you were to go back in time to, let's say, the first Crusader, Godfrey de Bouillon, would he have thought in any way, shape, or form that he was establishing some kind of colony for a modern nation state by participating in a crusade, right? That had nothing, that would never even have, he would not understand the words you would say to him in that regard. So for him, it really was an armed pilgrimage. That's why he was participating. And that's what most of the men who went on crusades saw what they were doing, was not establishing a colony that they could take resources or people from and send back to the mother country, or to the fatherland, if you will. But rather, they were going to protect Christians who were indigenous Christians in North Africa, the Holy Land, or other areas of Europe that were under attack. They were going to, again, liberate ancient Christian territory, reestablish that territory as Christian and under the patrimony of the church and protection of the church. And they were going for their own spiritual benefit. They were very much interested in their own salvation. These were people of faith, and they wanted to receive the indulgence, and they were concerned about their secular life and their focus on military endeavors for a secular purpose and how that placed their soul in danger, if you will.
The number is 888-318-7884. If you'd like to talk about the Crusades with Steve Weidenkopf, author of The Glory of the Crusades, you are very welcome to call. You don't have to be Christian to call. Maybe you're a practitioner of Islam and you want to call up and talk to these Catholics about the Crusades. We'd love to have that conversation. 888-318-7884. Steve, I think there are some people who will really roll the eyes hard when you say an armed pilgrimage. Like, it's very hard for us to conceive of such a thing or to give credence to it. I think we think, no, there's got to be another motive in there. They were going there to steal something, or there's just that armed pilgrimage thing sounds like a cover story.
Excuse me. That's actually not an uncommon myth, right, that people think of, oh, there had to be some sort of kind of modern day reason for why people went, right? Greed is one of the other major modern myths that people believe about the Crusades. This obviously was a land grab. This was a money, kind of land claim, if you will, as well. And I mean, even as an undergrad, that was one of the theories that was taught to me, that the reason why Crusaders, or one of the reasons why they went, was because at this time in Europe, at the end of the 11th century, you had a large population boom. And you had, because of the rights of primogeniture, where only the firstborn son inherited land and property as a result of the feudal system in Europe, you had all these second, third, and fourth-born sons from this population explosion that couldn't inherit land. They fought amongst each other, so the church wanted to quell the fighting and decided to gather all these second, third, and fourth-born sons up and send them to attack Islam in the Holy Land in North Africa to get their land that way. Which on the surface, okay, you're thinking, well, that seems somewhat logical, seems rational from a modern 20th century, 21st century perspective. Except when you do the research and find out that really, especially the very first crusade, the vast majority of the crusaders who went weren't second, third, and fourth born sons, they were first born sons. So it was the sons who stood in those areas the most to lose were the ones who actually went. So why is that? That's because families at the time, the French families in particular, where the vast majority of First Crusaders came from, were very much devoted to the holy city of Jerusalem. Many important French noblemen had made pilgrimages in the past to Jerusalem. It was a popular children's name, frankly, the actual city of Jerusalem. If you were to go back in time to a 12th, 11th century French baron's court, and he had a daughter, more than one daughter, more than likely one of those daughters was named Jerusalem. So the French were very much focused and devoted to the holy city. And so when the Holy Father, Pope Blessed Urban II, preached the First Crusade in France in 1095, it generated a lot of interest. And so families wanted to send their most important family member, their firstborn son, on crusade. And then you look at how much did it cost to actually go on crusade. One historian has done some great research in this area, and he's estimated that it cost an average knight four times his annual income to go on crusade. War is expensive. I think we know that in our own day and age. That's been true throughout all human history. It's still true today. War is very expensive. It was true for the crusaders. So many of these families had to sell their own land. Many of these families impoverished themselves, put their landed estates, mortgage them to get the money to be able to send one family member on crusade. And the vast majority who lived, who came back, there was not many did. 80% casualty rate on the first crusade, which is horrifically high. Those who did come home, more often than not, came home poorer poor, temporally speaking, for the experience. So this was not something that was entered into lightly by these families and by these warriors.
Again, the number is 888-318-7884. Steve Weidenkopf, our guest. We're talking the Crusades on a Friday afternoon. Love to get your call. 888-318-7884.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at Catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Beyond Damascus with Dan Demite and Aaron Richards is our show for young adults.
Everybody's talking about Encounter. Everybody's talking about that mountaintop experience. What we fail to often talk about is what happens after, what happens beyond that Damascus moment.
Jesus Christ is calling all of us to be missionary disciples, disciples of Jesus who are on mission to bring the kingdom of God here and now on this earth.
Beyond Damascus with Dan Demite and Aaron Richards, tomorrow at 8 Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. So happy to have Steve Weidenkopf with us. It's always a great privilege when he's here, and not teaching right now because it's not quite the school year yet at Christendom in Virginia, right? That's right, where you are, in Virginia.
Exactly, front row of Virginia.
If you want to talk about the Crusades, we'd love to have that conversation with you. 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Before I go to the phones, I have to ask you about one figure and why we have the view we have of him. We call him in the West, I can't remember what they call him in the East, but Saladin. Why do we see him as this noble creature in the West? Like, it's very weird thing that he came to have this, like, he was almost like the model of chivalry for European knights after a while.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, he was. So he's a prominent figure, right? In the most recent Hollywood production of the Crusades, if you will, was Ridley Scott's Kingdom of Heaven.
My goodness!
Back in 2005, I think that was. And yeah, that was not a very good portrayal of the historical movement of the Crusades. But he figures prominently in that story because it tells the time of right before the Third Crusade, when Saladin actually reconquers the city of Jerusalem from the Western Crusaders, right? So he's this kind of larger than life figure for many, many different reasons, right? So the Third Crusade is one of the most well famous crusades. So after Saladin reconquers Jerusalem for Islam, then the Third Crusade is called, and it's well known because it's sometimes referred to as the Three Kings Crusade. You had the three major monarchs of Europe at the time going on crusade here at the late 12th, early 13th century. And they were, you know, King Richard I, the Lionhearted of England, who's portrayed multiple times in all kinds of movies and historical pieces. You had Philip II Augustus of France, and you had Frederick Barbarossa, the King of the Germans and the Holy Roman Emperor. So very important monarchs go, and so they have to, you know, if the important monarchs are going, then there has to be an important villain or, you know, an enemy monarch that they're fighting against. And so it was Saladin, it's true. There were big battles between Saladin and Richard. There was a treaty ultimately that was signed between the two of them that kind of ended the Third Crusade. But really, Saladin begins to enter into the picture, really, of European thought a little bit later than that. I mean, well known during the time, if you will, and known as a good ruler and one that was, a worthy opponent of these major monarchs. But it's really in the 19th century with the literature of Walter Scott and others where you have Ivanhoe and these other kinds of romance novels where this idea of chivalry becomes more commonplace in Victorian England. And so you have this picture of the worthy heathen opponent, if you will, who, you know, King Richard of England, you know, fought against. And so he was portrayed as being, Saladin was, as somebody who was very, charitable, very fair, very, the noble heathen, if you will, sort of in a certain sense. And some of that is true about the real Saladin. He was a man who was known for being at times a fair ruler. He was also very ruthless. Was very much committed to jihad and to eradicating the Christian presence from the Holy Land, but a worthy military commander as well in some regards, more of a general strategy type of commander rather than a good battlefield tactical commander. But you know, that's where he enters into the European consciousness, and so much so that Kaiser Wilhelm II goes to Damascus in the late 19th century and wants to visit the tomb of this great Saladin because he's heard so much about him, and you know, these stories growing up as a child about the great Saladin, this worthy opponent of Richard and Frederick and Philip, and nobody could tell him where the tomb was in Damascus. The people there didn't know. They were, oh yeah, we have no. Oh. It took him a while. They had forgotten Saladin. In the Muslim world, Saladin was not upheld as this great model. It was a later commander by the name of Baybars who really was seen as being one who was more victorious and more important than Saladin in Muslim history. So he couldn't find the tomb finally. He eventually finds somebody who can tell him where it is. He goes and it's completely decrepit. It's been, you know, it's worn down. It's not been kept up. There's weeds everywhere. So he actually gives money, and if you will, endows a maintenance fund for the rebuilding of Saladin's tomb, in Damascus. So he was well more recognized in the Western world than even in the Muslim world.
How interesting. I had no idea. So in many ways, yeah, it's when all this stuff gets recycled through 19th century mass media, then a lot of the view changes. It's interesting that the modern Muslim romance of Saladin kind of gets its impetus from Christian Europe.
Exactly.
That's fascinating to me. All right, lots of folks on the line. So let's get to some calls. Ivan in Orange County, California, listening on Catholic.com. Go ahead with your question for Steve Weidenkopf.
Hi, Steve. I wanted to know, how did the Crusaders actually govern? Like, how did they deal with other religions already there? Did they do any social welfare programs, like against poverty and promoting marriage and elevation of the birth rate? And how did they deal with crime, and what lessons can we extract from them? And let's say dealing with Mexican drug cartels and our declining birth rates for modern times. Thank you.
Wow, yeah, that's great. A lot. Thanks. There's a lot of questions there, Ivan. I mean, I think generally speaking, we can talk about how the Crusaders governed. So for background purposes, right, the First Crusade happens between 1095 and 1102. In 1099, the First Crusaders are able to liberate the Holy City of Jerusalem. Before that, they liberate some other cities as well, Antioch as well as Nicaea, and they establish what we call them Crusader states. What these were feudal territories, so they create a political and a governing system that they were used to in Europe. So they create a series of counties and principalities. So you have the County of Edessa, the County of Tripoli, the Principality of Antioch, and the Kingdom of Jerusalem. So about a 600-mile stretch all the way from the north in Edessa all the way down through Jerusalem, mostly on the coast, are these areas that the First Crusaders had liberated. And so there's a Count of Edessa, for example, there's a Count of Tripoli, there's a Prince of Antioch, then there's a king eventually. Baldwin becomes king of Jerusalem as a result of the First Crusade. And so these rulers govern these feudal territories, and obviously the Crusaders are a minority among the population. They're ruling a majority Muslim population. And things really, for most of the people in these territories, the Muslim population, majority population, didn't really change, frankly. The Crusaders governed, by most accounts, they governed fairly and justly. We even have accounts of Muslim travelers going through these Crusader territories and actually commenting that in certain areas of these Crusader states, the Muslim population was treated better than they were under their own Muslim rulers in other areas of the Holy Land. There is even accounts of Templars, for example, on the Temple Mount, where there's a Muslim traveler who went to Jerusalem. He's praying on the Temple Mount, and there's a newly arrived pilgrim from Europe, a newly arrived crusader, who goes and accosts this Muslim traveler and this Muslim man who's praying, and complaining he's praying in the wrong direction, complaining that he's praying at all on the Temple Mount. And these two Templar knights come over to the crusader who just had arrived from Europe, and they kind of shuffle him off and get him out of the picture. And then they go back to the Muslim traveler and they apologize for the behavior of this newly arrived European, how he just didn't understand that it was perfectly acceptable for a Muslim man to pray in Jerusalem under Christian, when Jerusalem was under Christian control. Now, there were certain areas in Jerusalem that Muslims weren't allowed to go to or wouldn't allow to be pray or couldn't go to pray. But in generally speaking, they were treated very fairly with a great level of tolerance, and that was true throughout the Crusader states. So, you know, it was the – if you think about it, right, the crusading counts and noblemen had a great incentive to ensure that they treated the majority of people under their rule with fairness, because they needed people to work the fields, they needed, you know, commerce to continue, agriculture to continue, and there weren't enough Christians, indigenous or those who had settled from Europe, or even pilgrims, or there was a constant supply of pilgrims from Europe, but not enough who lived there to run an economy and to govern a society. So you had to be just in your dealings with the majority of Muslim population.
Ivan, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you very, very much for the question. Before we move on to the next question, I get the impression that there were among the Crusaders, and I may not understand who Reynard of Châtillon was at all, but there are some that seem very violent and all kind of scoundrels in a way. Sure. Was that the case?
Yeah, that is the case. I mean, every army, even among the crusading armies, right, various ones, even the First Crusade, you have people who, you know, didn't participate for, virtuous reasons, who didn't act virtuously, yeah. Rather. It's the same thing in modern day, right? And sadly, yeah. We have men in battle who are virtuous and men who aren't, and men who commit horrible atrocities and men who prevent them. It's true no matter what period of history you look at, frankly.
All right, we'll take a quick break. We'll get back to more calls on the Crusades on Catholic Answers Live.
Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you. Have you enrolled in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics? Let me ask you a more important question. Do you believe as a Catholic that you have an obligation to share the Catholic faith? In fact, the Church has answered this question, and the answer is that all confirmed Catholics are obliged to share the faith. It's actually in canon law. Catholic Answers is here to help you fulfill that obligation. Our School of Apologetics courses will equip you to help all the people you come in contact with understand what the Church teaches and why. A great place to start is with all the Catholics in your life. Learn the art of apologetics from the best of the best and start sharing the gospel today. Visit schoolofapologetics.com. That's schoolofapologetics.com.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I told you, it's always fun when we have Steve Weidenkopf on and talking about the Crusades. Great way to spend a summer afternoon. And if you've got questions about the Crusades, 888-318-7884 is the number, 888-318-7884. This is something that is very worth Christians, Catholics in particular, and Muslims talking about together. So if you are Muslim and you'd like to call, we'll take that call. We'd be happy to have it. Tom in Illinois, listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM satellite radio. Go ahead with your question for our guest, Steve Weidenkopf.
Yeah, I like to understand the evolution of the invasion of the Crusaders and coming into Jerusalem, but one incident that I read through that I think it's post, probably post the invasion, or at least the three wars of the Crusaders, is that the destruction of the Holy Sepulchre. I just was wondering that did the Crusaders' wars give rise to power and strength to the Ottoman Empire and the final destruction of the Hagia Sophia in Turkey, Constantinople? And did that relationship between Christians and Muslims over the years lead to the Sarajevo and Serbia wars, you know, Christians against the leftover, you know, because a lot of the Muslims that migrated and lived in that part of the world of Sarajevo were all part of the Ottoman Empire at one point through the diaspora. And then I'm thinking, it's just tit for tat. I mean, the Christians back in the 90s were, I mean, that's what it basically was, just, you know, we call it, you know, ethnic cleansing.
Right.
All right. Let Steve take a shot at that, and then we'll come back to see if the answer is satisfying to you. Steve?
Yeah, Tom, thanks for the question. Great questions. And so let's start off with the first question. I think you kind of were asking, what was the impetus for launching of the crusading movement? What really brought this on? Was it the destruction of the Holy Sepulchre that you mentioned? So a couple of things there, right? So the Church of the Holy Sepulchre was actually destroyed in the early part of the 11th century in the year 1009, when the Egyptian Sultan al-Hakim ordered its destruction. Now, al-Hakim, by all accounts, was a crazy man, frankly. He was pretty much insane. He was a very unpopular ruler, even among his own subjects. He subjected them to all kinds of various restrictions, but also attacked Christians and Jews that were living under his territories. And one way which he did that was order the destruction of the Holy Sepulchre. Now, that news of the destruction of the church made its way back to Christendom into Europe and was obviously something that was not accepted well, was accepted with great distress. But that in and of itself didn't really launch the crusading movement, if you will, because the crusading movement, as I mentioned earlier in the show, didn't really begin until the late 1000s, right, till 1095, to the end of the 11th century. So you got really almost 90 years between the time the Church of the Holy Sepulchre was first destroyed in the 11th century to when the crusading movement launched. So it wasn't that although that was disturbing for many Europeans who heard of it, that didn't really bring it about. It was eventually rebuilt a little bit later in the 1160s or the 1060s, and then when the first Crusaders got to Jerusalem, they added on to the church as well. So that didn't really launch it. So what did? Well, what happens in the latter part of the 11th century is you have a group of Muslims from the Asian steppe known as the Seljuk Turks. So they're Muslim, but they're not Arabs. They're not from the Arabian Peninsula. They come down off the Asian steppe into what is modern-day Turkey, but what was then the Byzantine imperial province of Anatolia. And they begin a series of conflicts and wars against the Byzantine Empire or the Eastern Roman Empire, right? This Christian empire in the East. And so because of the Seljuks and their invasion, there's a big battle that happens in 1071, the Battle of Manzikert, where an Eastern emperor is actually captured by the Seljuks. And over time, they begin to conquer this territory. So what launches it is the Byzantine emperor, a later one actually, Alexius I, sends representatives to the West, to the Pope, and asks for his help in marshaling Western knights to come to the East to help him defend his Christian territory against the invasion of the Seljuk Turks. Urban then kind of modifies, Pope Urban II modifies that request and turns it into just, hey, the Eastern Emperor wants mercenaries to come and help him defend his territory. Urban turns it into, as I mentioned earlier, this armed pilgrimage to go and to liberate the holy city of Jerusalem and to liberate specifically the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in order to, as an ancillary way, helping the Byzantine Empire, right? But that wasn't the primary objective of what Urban had launched. So that's really where the crusading movement begins and why it begins. You mentioned the Ottoman Turks. You have to fast forward a bit until the 14th century to the creation of the Ottoman Empire. And then when the Ottomans come to the scene, the crusading movement shifts in focus. So heretofore, before the 13th century, the focus was on liberating ancient Christian territory in North Africa and the Holy Land, and then maintaining that territory as much as possible, defending it. Over time, that crusaders are kicked out. out, and the Christian presence is kicked out, really, of the Holy Land. The last Crusader city, major city under control that falls is the city of Acre in 1291. And so then really things become, the movement shifts to now, once the Ottomans come to the picture, of defense of the European homeland, if you will. So the Ottomans launch incursions into what is the modern-day Balkans, as you mentioned, and even make their way into Vienna in the 16th and 17th century. So the movement changes from one of kind of more of an offensive liberation, if you will, defensive liberation, to a more defensive the homeland kind of posture. And so that's how the Ottomans come to the picture. And then the Balkans themselves, right, you mentioned the former Yugoslavia, Serbia, Kosovo, all these areas of Europe. Many different reasons why there's ethnic tension there between you have, because you have so many different groups present there. You've got Christians, you've got different kinds of Christians there, you've got Muslims, you have different ethnicities, different cultures. A lot of that, it was, if you will, kind of pacified when the Ottomans were ruling the territory, and even when the, you know, Yugoslavia was created as well. And all that kind of dissipates at the end when Yugoslavia goes away. So those areas, that more modern day issue had more to do, I think, with geopolitical questions and concerns than more so kind of reliving of the Crusades, if you will, or an outgrowth of the Crusades. So I hope that helps.
Tom, I got to leave it there because I got to take a quick break. It's time for our break here at Catholic Answers Live. There are a couple lines open. So if you have questions about the Crusades that you would like to ask our guest, Steve Weidenkopf, please give us a call, 888-318-7884. There was a time when Steve Weidenkopf gave a talk at our Catholic Answers Conference, and it was one of the best received we've ever had. And just saying that gives me the opportunity to invite you again to the conference. 1 month from now, we'll be meeting here in San Diego. Find out all about it at CatholicAnswersConference.com.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
We have a big problem. Our culture is dying, and souls are in danger of being lost. The answer is conversion to Jesus Christ in His church. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a Catholic organization, and we have hundreds of teens spreading the good news throughout the country. But we need your help. The harvest is great, but the laborers are few. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
How are you listening to EWTN Radio right now? Have you ever wished you could listen on a local radio station? Maybe our Lord is speaking to your heart to help make that happen. Don't let a lack of experience hold you back. Find out how you can help start a Catholic radio station where you live. Powered by the truth of the church and EWTN's dynamic radio programming. Email Steve at this address, radio@EWTN.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Our guest is Steve Weidenkopf, who teaches history at the Graduate School of Christendom College. Right now, I'm having a little bit of an audio problem, so I'm just going to try to work my way through it here. But I'm going to let Steve take the next question. Walker in Omaha, Nebraska, listening on 102.7 FM. Walker, go ahead with your question for Steve.
Hey guys, thanks so much for the show. This is awesome. Love this topic. I think it's way not understood. My question is that I've listened to a book called The Crusades by author Thomas Asbridge. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it or not. One of my favorite books. He goes very into detail about all of the Crusades. But one of the main points that stuck out to me was that there was a large groups of people living in the Holy Land, Muslims, Christians, Jews, and they were living in relative harmony with each other. And, you know, they would have never fought each other, never gone to war, unless it was for the idea of government and the idea of motivation for, you know, taking over land, you know, whatever interests that there might be. And I find that fascinating, is that the natural state of people is to be in harmony with you. They traded with each other. They grew crops together. They even had relationships with each other. So if you could elaborate a little bit on that, And then my second question is kind of more specific, but when the First Crusade took over Antioch, there is a story about, I think, a crusader named Paul who said that there is a spear that held one of the nails of Christ's crucifixion, and he decided to dig a hole in the city of Antioch, and they actually found a spear in that hole, and they used it throughout the next leg of the journey from Antioch to Jerusalem. So I really appreciate your expertise, and I love Catholic Answers, and you guys are awesome. So thank you.
Thanks, Walker.
Yeah, great, Walker. Thanks. Thanks for the questions there, and I'm glad you're listening on the show here. So, yeah, I mean, you know, the general point from Albridge is correct, right? That in the areas of the Holy Land, North Africa, and even in parts of Europe, obviously, you have the, you know, different groups living together relatively in peace: Christians, Muslims, Jews, and you know, so one thing to think about in history, right, is it's easy for us, or we try to, in many ways, we kind of take historical events and we try to make sense of them in our own worldview, in our own time, and our own experiences, and many times I think we portray historical events as more black and white than they actually were, right? Partly that's because we need to understand the information, we need to understand what happened, we need to understand the story, and so in some ways that construct helps us to do that. But along the way, sometimes we do forget that there are gray areas, right? That history is a complex series of events, of human interactions. Most of us are not just black and white people, right? We're gray. Sometimes we're virtuous, sometimes we're not. Thank God if we're Catholic, we can go to the sacrament of confession when we're not virtuous, and we receive the grace in order to, you know, to live the way we should. And it's true of the people that came before us, right? So there was a lot of gray and a lot of complexity that involved human interactions and human relationships all throughout history. There were times when again, Muslims, Christians, and Jews lived in harmony, even in the Holy Land, but there are also times when that wasn't the case. And really, my answer to the last question is kind of when that began to change in that area of the world, which launched the crusading movement, and that was the arrival of the Seljuk Turks, right? There were a different group of people who were bent on conquest, who were bent on gathering and getting land, and they disrupted the peace and harmony in many areas that had existed previously. And so when news of that got – so, for example, right, another reason why the Crusades launched in this time was because you had reports of European pilgrims going to Jerusalem and being harassed and being attacked. Right? For generations before that, for decades before that, Christian pilgrims had gone and were not harassed or not attacked en masse. Maybe a few individuals were, but not en masse. At least we don't have accounts of that, right? So that changes when the dynamic of the area changes with this new group of people. So that brings the added complexity to it, which then launched the movement, if you will. And then your second question had to do with the liberation of the city of Antioch. And the finding of it was the finding of the spearhead or the point of the Holy Lance of Longinus, if you will. Saint Longinus traditionally was the Roman centurion who took his spear and speared the side of Christ on the cross. And so there, once the Crusaders got into the holy city of Antioch, it was a brutal siege that had lasted months, and they were on the near part of starvation, and disease was rampant, and they had lost a lot of their army. They finally get into the city. The very next day, a large Muslim relief army shows up and besieges them. So now they're stuck behind the walls, and they have to fight this big. So morale was at a very bad part. Was very low. And this rumor broke out that there was a pilgrim in the city by the name of Peter Bartholomew, who had a vision of Saint Andrew, who had come to him and told him that the spearhead of Saint Longinus was in the city, was in this particular church. And so Crusaders believed him, some didn't. Interestingly, the papal legate who was in the city at the time with the army, a man by the name of Bishop Adhemar of Le Puy, he discredited, or he didn't believe the story of Peter Bartholomew because he had seen the lance head of St. Longinus in Constantinople. So he seemed this was a kind of a specious report, but a lot of people did believe him, including some important Crusader nobles. They did begin to dig, and then kind of miraculously, mysteriously, however you want to characterize it, they did find a lance head, and morale kind of changed. So that's the interesting story of the spearhead or the spear point of St. Longinus in Antioch.
Thanks, Walker. I got to keep moving because we're getting near the end and we got a bunch more questions. So let's go to Pennsylvania. Jay in Pennsylvania, listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Jay, go ahead with your question for Steve Weidenkopf.
Yeah, thank you so much. I'm enjoying the program. I just had a question about the indulgences as a motivation for the Crusaders and how that evolved. And I've heard something about this, that the indulgences evolved in a way that sort of relieved the responsibility or the moral responsibility of the killing that they had to do. And so kind of two parts of the question. One, it seems sort of not right morally to say, okay, you go there and you fight this battle and your sins will be forgiven. And then to take it further and say, okay, if you commit sort of these, you know, potentially reprehensible acts, that yes, you know, you will derive, you'll be absolved of it, if you will. So kind of two parts to that, how it evolved and what was the justification for it. It doesn't sort of sit morally correct, at least in my mind.
Yeah, Jay, great question. So there's a recent scholar, a Scandinavian scholar by the name of Anne Bystedt, who wrote her dissertation on the indulgence and the crusading indulgence and the theology behind it and how it changed and evolved over time and how it was applied as well during the crusading movement. So I probably can't get that outside of an academic library, or maybe you could probably try to get it on Amazon, but it would be, I'm sure, quite expensive. But anyways, her thesis is fantastic. So if you're really interested in this subject, I would encourage you to look into it in more detail. But one thing to focus on, you bring a point, right, is that the indulgence and the understanding of the indulgence and how it was applied and the theology of it did kind of change and evolve and develop over time during the coursing of the crusading movement, right? In terms of its practical as pastoral application, what conditions one had to meet in order to receive the indulgence. Right. As we know, as Catholics, there are conditions associated with receiving an indulgence. That's true today. It was true then. So the way that was initially focused and through the movement was, I want to kind of reorient the question, right, or at least the premise. Your premise is kind of based on, well, these men are killing other warriors, other men, and so they can receive an indulgence for killing. And that's not really what they understood they were doing, and that not how the indulgence was applied to them, right? In the mind of the church, in the mind of Pope Urban, who first began the granting of the indulgence to these warriors, for him, what was the act, if you will, that allowed the indulgence was the spiritual aspect of the crusade, right? The fact that they were participating in this armed pilgrimage that he had called it was a pilgrimage. Indulgences were associated with pilgrimage before the crusading movement. And what made this different, obviously, was the armed nature of it and the warfare of it. But the indulgence was associated with the arduous task upon which the pilgrim undertook. And that was the actual travel, going to the Holy Land, the engaging in combat, the putting of himself at risk and at danger in defense of other Christians, in defense of Christian property, in defense of the church. That's how they saw it. They saw it more from a defensive mindset than how kind of we would see it, maybe, if you will, or how your question implies it, from a more offensive perspective, right? They received an indulgence because they were killing people. That's not really, again, the mindset they had, right? You have to kind of flip the mindset. For them, it was, I'm receiving an indulgence because I'm participating in something that is so arduous, that is at the risk of my life, but it's something that is, I'm using my military skills, but it's in defense of the church. It's in defense of Christians. It's in defense of my own life. It's not because I'm just going willy-nilly killing everybody that I can find, right? And so you had to meet those conditions. You had to be prayerful. You had to show that you were penitential through the crusading movement or through your pilgrimage. And if not, then you could be denied the indulgence. And if you didn't complete your vow, if you didn't go to Jerusalem, If you, you vowed and volunteered and said, yeah, I'm going to go, but then you never do, you didn't get the indulgence. It wasn't something automatic. You had to show during the course of your actions of the during the crusade that you were penitential, that you, you know, that you were participating in a holy way. And there were many men who didn't, right? Armies are full of virtuous and non-virtuous people, true then, true today. And many men were punished for unvirtuous behavior and for not acting the way they should have penitentially on crusade.
KJ?
Yeah, that's very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. So Richard, the Lionheart, he didn't get the indulgence because I don't think he made it into Jerusalem. Or was it if you tried?
Yeah, he got he got close. I mean, he saw Jerusalem, and then he entered into a treaty with Saladin so others could go to Jerusalem, yeah. So they completed their vow. He didn't actually go into the city despite the truce, and there's some conjecture the reason why he didn't visit the city and fulfill his vow then during the truce was because he perhaps was thinking he would try to come back. He would make another expedition. He never was able to, but yeah.
All right. And we all know what happened in Sherwood Forest when he got back. Jay, thanks for the question. James in New Orleans, listening on the app. Thanks very much for downloading the app onto your phone. James, go ahead with your question for Steve Weidenkopf.
Hey, guys. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much for your wonderful work. And I'm just wondering... on the Northern European Germanic perspective of this, so to say.
Because you mentioned that it was mostly French, at least in the First Crusade. So how did this all look to the Northern German, the Northern Europeans?
Yeah, so there was some Europeans who did go, or some non-French, right, more Northern Europeans who participated in all of the Crusades, especially even the First Crusade. We have Crusaders from England. One of the most famous Crusaders of the First Crusade was Godfrey de Bouillon, who came from Alsace-Lorraine, which was, you know, German-French kind of mix, if you will, that area. Many other Germans participated. There were later on in the crusading movement, as I mentioned earlier, campaigns against the pagan tribes that were on the more, you know, eastern borders of what is modern-day Germany, Poland, into the Baltic states now, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia. And those were a little bit different of the campaigns, right, than those towards North Africa and the Holy Land, because it was a situation where these were pagan tribes. Many of them were very barbaric. Some of them practiced cannibalism. Some of them even human sacrifice. So those crusades were a bit different. They tended to be historically a bit more nasty in terms of how the warfare was conducted because of the nature of who the crusaders were dealing with. But it really comes about, those campaigns begin really towards the Second Crusade in the 12th century, where St. Bernard of Clairvaux really is the one who kind of opens up this aperture of people come to him and say, you know, hey, we have these pagans that are on our borderlands that are raiding and attacking us. Can we defend ourselves and even try to help maybe even bring about you know, the pacification and even conversion of these tribes by engaging in conflict with them, would that be acceptable? And that was something that Bernard agreed with and thought that would be something that kind of fit the mold of this crusading movement. Different, just as the Reconquista in Spain was a bit different than what was going on in North Africa and the Holy Land as well. So from a Northern German perspective, there was a lot of focus on those pagan tribes to the east, but many Germans throughout the crusading movement participated in the more traditional crusades, if you will, to the Holy Land.
Okay, James?
Thank you so much. You've sewed it up for me.
Thank you, James.
Thank you so much.
Great.
I don't want to neglect to ask you this. What about the Jews in the Crusades? You mentioned that this is an event that involves Muslims, Christians, and Jews. What were the Crusades like for them?
Yeah, well, sadly, for many Jews, especially in Europe, it was a time of great distress, of violence even. There were pogroms that erupted in the First Crusade, with the calling of the First Crusade in the 1090s, 1096. There were, sadly, many men who took the crusading vow, never actually made their way to the Holy Land, but really took the crusading vow and took this opportunity to wage warfare and violence against Jews, especially in the Rhineland. Their thought and their mentality, Count Emmet of Flaunheim was the most famous of these, who gathered a group of men and went to various cities along the Rhine and attacked the Jewish communities there. And his reasoning for it was, you know, why should I travel thousands of miles away to you know, liberate ancient Christian territory and attack Muslims when they're enemies of Christ here in the Rhineland? At least, again, that was his mentality, right? Not called for by the church, not sanctioned by the Pope. In fact, in many of these areas and these cities, the bishops of the towns tried to protect the Jews and the Jewish community as much as possible. So not something sanctioned at all. But sadly, there were those who took the opportunity, opportunists, if you will, to attack the Jewish communities and for their own benefit, for their own gain, for their own enrichment. And that was condemned at the time as it should have been.
Steve Weidenkopf, it's just a great privilege to have you here. Thanks for taking all the time and discussing the Crusades with us here on a lovely Friday afternoon. Thanks, Steve.
Thank you, Si. I appreciate it. God bless.
Steve, we do me one other favor. Will you just say the name of your latest book for Catholic Answers Press, the one on crisis in the church?
Yeah, it's Light from Darkness. So nine times the Catholic Church was in turmoil, but came out stronger than before.
Great book. And again, thanks, Steve. Thanks to our earlier guests, Simone Rizcala. And thanks to all of you. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.